Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Imam Al-Mahdi. Brothers and sisters, sunlight is the source of all activity on this earth, and no living creature can continue to live without it. The fact that it sometimes comes from behind the clouds does not diminish its utility. And the same applies to the light from a divine imam and leader in the context of man's spiritual and human life. Sun hidden by a cloud, just like a light behind a translucent glass, sends out a considerable part of its light and removes the darkness of night and benefits the living plants and creatures. The spiritual blessings of the imam illuminate the human world even from behind the hiding curtains. But just as the amount of sunlight entering a building depends on its openings, people's share from this light of leadership is proportionate to the method and degree of their relation and connection with the imam. Sometimes we get asked that you have Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam, the 12th imam, who is in occultation, who is hidden, who is behind the curtains. He's not accessible to us while he is living on this earth. But then, what is the use of such an imam? So we say, it's just like that sunlight. It reaches from behind the clouds to the creatures, and it is a source of life for them. The very presence of the 12th imam, of Imam al-Mahdi, Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, also benefits humanity from behind the clouds, where our eyes cannot see him, where our perceptions cannot fathom him, where our physical beings cannot at will go and meet him. But yet, he is looking after the affairs of the entire humanity. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about Imam al-Mahdi and his effects and impacts on our lives. How do we benefit in our day-to-day life from the imam of the time who is in occultation? Yes, we cannot just go and knock at his door and talk to him. Yes, he's in occultation, but how do we benefit from him? Guess what? Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam was asked the same or similar question. He was asked, how can people enjoy the existence of an invisible and hidden imam? He replied, just as they enjoy sunlight from behind the clouds. You know how you benefit from the rays of sun that are maybe not directly reaching you because the sun is behind the clouds. Similarly, the fadl and the grace of imam, the blessings of imam, reach the humanity from behind the curtain of his ghaibah and his occultation. The Shia is waiting for the living imams, right? For waiting for his advent is one of the highest forms of worship. From the Shia point of view, and you know the history, it tells us the world will certainly witness the government of justice of the imam of the time, and tyrannical systems will cease to exist, right? So our lives are being directly impacted by the concept of the reappearance of Imam Zaman alayhi salam, the Imam of the time, Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. He will fill up the world with divine justice as it would have been filled with injustice and oppression. These are the traditions that we have firm belief on, and these are the traditions that are accepted widely throughout Muslims and Islam. So this Imam has a very direct connection with our lives and the life of this planet Earth. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents, who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority, are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the attorney general who will quash the corruption charges against him. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion, the ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. But Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. A report released in June 2019 by the U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination, and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Calamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hand of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interest.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is why the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons, which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
The war war on Yemen is escalating like never before. When Saudi Arabia launched what it described as a three-week offensive back in March 2015, it bombed and bombed and carried on bombing, with the stated aim of bringing back to power Yemen's former president Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi, despite his term ending in 2014. His refusal to leave power triggered a popular uprising. Till this day, Saudi warplanes continue their airstrikes, hitting funerals, weddings, school buses, and even hospitals. Nothing has been spared. Rights groups accuse the Saudi regime of war crimes. And as the war enters its seventh year, Yemeni forces are fighting back and hitting the Saudis where it hurts on an almost daily basis. Under a tight blockade, Yemen has built indigenous missiles and drones that are targeting Saudi oil facilities deep inside the kingdom. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is trying to avoid humiliation and has therefore put forward a ceasefire proposal, the second in less than a year, an offer that Yemen has rejected.
The problem with this so-called new Saudi peace proposal is that there is nothing new about it. It doesn't really go beyond, at least at the initial release in the beginning of the day, the statement of the Saudis didn't go beyond any basic, you know, platitudes of peace and negotiation and, you know, trying to end the war through political talks, without really going into the details as to how Saudi Arabia wants to achieve this. Yes, the Saudis say that they want to reopen Sana'a airport, that they want to end the blockade on Hodeidah seaport, but there is not really a clear condition that will allow Yemen to really reinvigorate and relive.
A spokesman for the popular Ansar Allah movement says Yemen is ready to enter a political dialogue after Saudi Arabia stops the war and lifts its siege on Yemen. Mohammed Abdus Salam says putting forward ideas that have been discussed for over a year now is nothing new. Yemeni drones and missiles are also striking Saudi military bases where warplanes take off to carry out their air raids. On the ground itself, Yemeni forces are close to capturing the gas and oil-rich city of Ma'rib from Saudi-backed militants loyal to the former Yemeni government.
Ma'rib is located in the center of Yemen, in the historical heartland of Yemen as well. And so for them, this is a very important base of operations. So if they lose Ma'rib, they're basically losing all control over the front lines in which they are fighting against the troops of the National Salvation Government in central Yemen. So that is why this negotiation is basically, this plan, I think, is basically coming forth out of a fear to lose Ma'rib.
Ma'rib is strategically located near the Saudi border. It is the last main area that Saudi-backed forces control. Should Yemeni forces take control of the city, it will strike a heavy blow to Riyadh. In essence, the tables have turned. The offensive that would take 3 weeks has turned into a pipe dream. Saudi Arabia has resumed its aerial assaults using Western-made weapons. Human rights groups, as well as observers on the ground, say many of these airstrikes are inaccurate, indiscriminate, and hit residential areas, killing civilians. Rights groups and international bodies say Western countries are complicit in Saudi war crimes by selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of arms to the kingdom, as well as assisting Riyadh with intelligence and training for its pilots. Ansar Allah says it and allied forces have no option but to expand their retaliatory operations against targets inside Saudi Arabia and to, quote, liberate every inch of the country's soil through armed struggle. So the Saudi war in Yemen continues. Since the truce offer, Yemeni forces have hit Saudi targets and, not for the first time, have also brought down an American reconnaissance drone. It has left many asking if the ceasefire proposal was an admission of defeat by the Saudis.
Definitely is. It is a start of Saudi Arabia coming to terms with the fact that they, I would say diplomatically that they might not lose, not win this war, but I think it's pretty certain to say that they will not win this war. But this is a Vietnam War kind of scenario that Saudi Arabia has really sunk itself into the swamp of trying to conquer, trying to subdue, trying to dominate and subjugate Yemen.
Saudi Arabia appears to be stuck in a quagmire. Analysts have described the ceasefire offer as a public relations exercise to portray Yemeni forces as the aggressors while the kingdom seeks a way out of the costly military disaster it created both in Yemen and back at home. As the global population is sharply growing, one commodity is in sharp decline: water. According to the World Bank, the population growth together with climate change will result in water scarcity, something researchers say will pose all kinds of problems and threats. In essence, almost everything depends on water: mankind, animals, energy, and even land. As countries mark World Water Day, many governments around the world have been organizing campaigns to raise awareness that every drop counts. In Brazil, under the waters of many of Rio de Janeiro's coastline, lies trash from fishermen and locals. According to Brazilian environmentalists, this is seriously threatening the safety of the natural ecosystem. The South American country throws some 325,000 tons of plastic into the sea, and the pollution affects some 100 coastal lagoons of the Rio de Janeiro state coast. An environmental group has held a cleanup event. They are using scuba gear to pick up trash littering the bottom of the sea, an effort to protect the country's water and biodiversity.
It's already important as a commodity today. So if you don't think of water as an important commodity, it's probably because you live in an urban area or in a developed country where tap water is drinkable. But if you move out of these spaces, you'll realize how precious drinking water is.
Water is essential. Water is needed to drink, for hygiene and for agriculture. So water will be the basis of civilization, the basis of human life, for as long as we can foresee, and therefore water resources will be very important.
Researchers say the water sanitation problems in large swathes of the planet are a real danger. Rivers are running dry, lakes are being contaminated, and groundwater is being depleted. Growing demands from agriculture, energy production, and climate change are also contributing to the increasingly short supply of water. NGOs are doing their best to play a part too.
NGOs have spent a lot of money funded by donors to expand the supply network, to give access to people to water. So through the construction of wells and piped water systems, where the issue for my research is that money is not available for the maintenance and upkeep of these systems. So you might give people initial access to water, but how do you maintain that? How do communities maintain that access to water?
Experts say over the past decades, the best sources of drinking water have been severely degraded because of overuse and bad preservation management. From the United States to Australia to the Middle East, huge areas of the world are drying up. According to the World Health Organization, billions of people around the world are suffering from poor access to safe drinking water. There is a growing body of research suggesting that the shortage of this vital commodity will lead to armed conflicts between nations. International organizations are sounding the alarm about the dangers of territories being on the verge of an epic drought. Concern has been raised as to whether a lack of drinking water will lead to armed conflict between nations in the future.
There have been at times when water scarcity has led to serious international tensions. One example is in the Middle East between Syria, Jordan, and Israel over the Jordan River and the allocation of its water resources. That has not led to actual war, but it certainly led to an increase in political tensions.
I think any resource that is scarce can lead to wars, especially one that is so crucial to our lives. Even as of now, water has led to a lot of dispute, so I wouldn't...
By 2050, more than half of the global population is expected to face water stress. Water stress is when demand outweighs available water resources. More than 2 billion people live in countries experiencing water stress. 1 in 5 children worldwide do not have enough water to meet their daily needs. 2 in 5 people worldwide, or 3 billion, do not have a hand washing facility with water and soap at home. Providing access to safe drinking water and sanitation in 140 low- and middle-income countries would cost $114 billion per year. Agriculture accounts for nearly 70% of global water withdrawals. Climate change is altering rainfall patterns, reducing water availability, and worsening the damage caused by floods and droughts around the world. In a statement to mark the occasion, the European Union said access to sufficient, safe, acceptable, physically accessible and affordable water remains a challenge in many parts of the world. The bloc also warned that sustainable management of water resources requires global action through strong international cooperation and that everyone needs to play their full part in ensuring inclusive access to water and sanitation worldwide.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, brothers and sisters, other life forms. This is Youth Station. I am your humble host, Zainab. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Abu Muhammad. Happy to be here.
Assalamu alaikum, bro. Yeah, this is a question that I have had on my mind for a really, really long time. What is the significance of memorizing the Holy Quran? Like, why even? And then what? If I could put it in better. I know that there are ahadith about, you know, the importance of memorizing the Quran, but I feel like that those ahadith could possibly apply to a time where, you know, people were not literate and they couldn't read, they couldn't write 1400 years ago. It wasn't like today that everyone had a cell phone and on their cell phone they had an application that had the entire Quran with like 17 different tafasir and audio and animations and YouTube references and this and that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. But if you think about it, to imagine yourself having a YouTube channel for your reference, and you have like a huge topic, and you don't know what's in that channel. You don't know the different playlists. You don't know the different videos that are published in that. And you have a question in your mind. How are you going to find your way through that YouTube channel and find what you're looking for? Ideally, if you have a good grasp of all the content they have, and ideally if you've gone through all of their content so many times, you've got it in your hand that whenever you have a question, you know exactly which playlist to go to, which video to go to, and yep. You've got the answer over there.
True.
That's what memorizing the Quran does. That
do you actually have to memorize it to do that?
You end up
though?
Memorizing the titles of the videos at least, right? Because you know exactly which video is going to talk about what. I mean, when I say memorization, okay, I would go as far as saying that even if we don't want to memorize it fully, like word to word,
yeah.
We should have a really good grasp of the Quran, because at the end of the day, if you want to use it as our life manual,
yeah.
And we should know exactly what's there. Now,
true,
if you
true.
Think about it now, every verse of the Quran has a specific message. So every verse of the Quran is like a YouTube video.
True.
A title of a YouTube video, which itself has a whole amount of content in it. So it's like you've sort of memorized all the names of the playlists in a YouTube channel, that whenever you have a question, you know exactly which one to go to, and you're going to find 10 videos in that. Every verse of the Quran has depth in it, like 10, 15 videos worth of content in each mm-hmm. verse. So you're sort of like memorizing a playlist, like titles of playlists. But that's just like, you know, a metaphor. But in reality, if we look at the Quran as a whole, the Quran is a book of guidance. Every single verse has a specific message for different aspect of our life, for different situations.
I totally understand
the
that.
The ideal situation is to memorize it. We're not saying it is wajib and you have to, otherwise
yeah.
you're not a Muslim. Obviously, that's not the case. But I would say the ideal situation is if you have it at the top of your mind the whole time, then any situation you come to, you can quickly pick out the verse that's relevant to that. You don't need to be like, oh, 1 second, let me just quickly go through my search and then look for keywords and then find like 10 verses with the keywords. By the time the situation is gone and you failed, you see? So having that is a really ideal situation. Okay, is it possible for everybody? That's a difference. That's a different
exactly, because I'm thinking, number one, 70% of us are like that. Like, I wouldn't say I have a very good grasp on the Quran, but if I am looking for a verse, I roughly know which areas to go and look into, right? But then again, there are also some situations where people do, the word that they use for it is, they do hef, they're the hafidh, right? They're
yeah,
the
yeah.
people who've memorized the Quran. And they don't even know the meaning of the verses that well. And I understand that when you are a vessel to the words of Allah, it purifies you and it cleanses you and it, you know, brightens your heart automatically and naturally, because that's the quality of the Quran, and that's awesome and hunky-dory and all, but and then what?
Yeah, but you see, you're looking at the complete extreme situation where a person literally all he does is memorizes it and doesn't understand a word and doesn't even act on it. Obviously, in that situation, we would say, oh, yeah, don't waste your time, okay? Don't tire yourself. Although this can be a reason to then go in, you know, a wake-up call to go in and understand it and act on it. What we're saying is that middle ground where, you know, we memorize it for a purpose, and that purpose is to then be able to use it. And one of the best ways to memorize the Quran is to memorize it whilst also reading the translation at least. Now, I know teachers
yeah.
who give programs of memorization, and whilst they're memorizing, the teacher expects them to not only read the translations, but also read a small amount of tafsir of each verse.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be a really
and
good
I
way
think
of
that,
doing it.
I think that is awesome, but that's only possible for those who are intending to be experts in the field of Quran.
I disagree completely. And we can see that in the West, it's true that we don't have this concept of memorization. People
but
in Pakistan, people in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Africa, how many people are able to memorize the Quran? It's just that, come on, let's be honest, we're a bit lazy. We don't want to put the time in.
But if it's in that
and they're not experts
of study,
they're
okay.
not experts in the Quran. They're normal people who just give importance to memorizing
what
the Quran.
What else do they do with their lives? I'm just
they have
you know,
the students, the workers, and they memorize the Quran as well.
In like, that depth.
Yeah, it's not. I'm not saying depth in the sense you read the whole of Tafsir al-Mizan. Okay, I'm saying, you know, for example,
which really isn't a bad idea, by the way.
It would be ideal if one can do that, but obviously we don't want to make make it sound like, you know, an impossible task. We have things like, okay, I agree on this part that in terms of resources in English, we're close to zero.
Yeah,
we need to step that up. And if anybody's listening to this and is interested in helping out translating certain things, then they should put themselves forward, because we really have a lot of resources in Arabic and Farsi. Like recently, like we've been talking about tafsir with some friends, and there's a tafsir, one volume tafsir of the Quran. Each page has a small amount of tafsir on the side. You get the main two, three points that a person can learn from this verse of the Quran. It's a one volume tafsir, right? It's something that you can easily read and finish in about 2 years if you read one page a day, which is reasonable. Like that's 20 minutes a day. And if you're not ready to put 20 minutes a day for the Quran, then I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Okay, so it's realistic. It's possible to do that. Now, yes, we don't have such a thing in English, and this should be worked on. And yes, I agree, that's a weakness on our side. But the actual question is, yes, we should give importance to doing hifz of the Quran, because it makes us close to the Quran. At the least, it makes us close to the Quran. If you're going to repeat something every day, at least 20 minutes, half an hour, then you're definitely going to get close to it. You're going to get close to it emotionally. You're going to, at some point, ponder on the meanings if you've been reading the meanings. Exactly. And it's definitely going to have an effect.
And you're going to begin to, like, be able to relate to it more.
Definitely.
As you go forth in life, you get into real-life situations. And then because you're so associated with the Holy Quran, you're like, oh my God, that verse literally is applying to me right now, and I'm living
and
it.
And it literally comes to your mind like a flash,
exactly.
Like, oh, this is what that was.
Yeah.
And sometimes when real life situations come, that's when you actually appreciate the meaning of a particular verse,
true.
Which you hadn't perhaps appreciated whilst you were memorizing.
I had a friend, and I remember her transition pre and post memorization of the Quran, and after it, I noticed that her memory became strengthened, and it was like, she turned into this alpha. You know how they say elephants don't forget anything? She could remember everything by detail and moment and place and exact time. And this, are you a hafid?
Unfortunately, I'm not.
Why?
Why? I hope I'm not one of those people I was just criticizing earlier and saying they don't want to put 20 minutes aside every day.
Exactly.
The reason I haven't done it is I'm a student in the Hawza, and the program is quite intensive. And for myself personally, I feel it's more important for me to first learn certain things before I go into Hifz of the Quran. Though I really want to do Hifz, then something that I'm planning to do hopefully soon. But my priority as a student right now was to learn some other stuff before. At the same time, getting acquainted with the Quran, with the meanings of the Quran, but not at the level of doing Hifz of it.
Yeah,
this was my personal situation. I want to emphasize that this is a personal situation. And everybody's in a different situation, and things change from person to person. We're not saying everybody should start learning the Quran as soon as they listen to this episode. We should need to balance out, see what's important, prioritize things, and definitely make a point to bring this up sometime in our life. Hopefully, as early as possible, because
exactly,
when you get older,
but
then
here's the thing. Okay, 3 points here. Number one, it's never too late, or
it's
even
too
early.
Late, yeah.
As a matter of fact, we have a lot of child prodigies that started memorizing the Quran when they were wee lads, and we have people who it's like Ayatollah Khomeini, who memorized the Quran when they were like 96, 97
yeah.
of age. Second point is that you said that you're a student of Hawza, but you haven't gotten around to actually memorizing the Quran yet. And I felt for a second that there's absolutely no contradiction between being a student of Hawza and memorizing the Quran, because at the end of the day, the knowledge that you're receiving is from the source, which is the Quran itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yes,
right?
That's the main thing. The issue comes when, like, we have, for example, some people who study a lot, but then they don't refer to the Quran.
Mm.
So we should definitely, as students of the Hawza, definitely be acquainted with the meanings of the Quran.
Mm.
Ideally, we should do Hifz, and I see myself faulty, and I do really genuinely feel guilty for not putting that time aside. But again, because of circumstances, I haven't been able to so far. But I really want to, and it's like one of my plans in the near future.
If you could like do a comparison, supposedly, a person who knows the Quran pretty well, spends every day around 20 minutes, half an hour reciting the Quran with its meaning, supposing they don't understand Arabic, and hasn't necessarily memorized the Quran. They've skimmed through a few tafasir, And they have a pretty decent command over the holy book. They understand it, and they have a pretty good grasp of it. And if you ask them for a verse, they know roughly where to refer you to. By roughly, I mean they know which ayah, yeah, around which area his or Juz. They just don't know, like, the number exactly. They know which, yeah, surah. And this and that. And like I said, they have read a few tafasir, so they understand pretty well the concept and the commentary of the depth of each verse,
yeah,
but they haven't memorized it. Because I feel that's the case with a lot of Hawzawi students, right? The, yeah, students of the seminary, they understand the Quran pretty well because whether they're studying akhlaq or ahkam, but almost every other lesson, they're constantly referring to the holy book, you know? This is haram, this is halal because of this verse and this verse and this verse and this hadith and that hadith. And, you know, it's backing up their knowledge, right? Their sciences.
Yeah, definitely.
But so they haven't memorized it. Compare that with a person who's memorizing the Quran for the sake of being a hafiz.
Yeah, but doesn't know anything, yeah, about the Quran. Yeah.
And they spend, look, bro, don't tell me you haven't seen people who 20 minutes a day, they sit with the Quran in front of them and their friend is there to help them do tathbeet. And they're reading the Quran on, like, fast forward. They're going, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And that person is, their friend, is nodding their head and nodding their head. And when they get, like, a word wrong, their friend is like, well, go back.
If these guys are also people who act on the Quran, then definitely this is not a bad
thing.
Define
acting, yeah, on the Quran. We're Muslims at the end of the day. What else do we act on? The Bible?
You'll be surprised. You'll be surprised. I don't want to get into that. But yeah, I mean, if a person memorizes the Quran and for the sake of practicing and just quickly, you know, making sure he's done hifz properly, he just does a fast forward, presentation of his hifz apart, then for that it's not a problem to do that. As long as the purpose of his hifz is to be able to refer to the Quran, get closer to it, be able to use it on a daily basis in his studies and so on, then it's a very good thing. But as you said, the priority is to understand the Quran and get close to its meaning. That's the priority. If you had to choose between doing hifz and understanding the Quran in more depth, my humble take on it, based on what I have what the inspiration I've got from my teachers, is that give priority to understanding the Quran And then if you also have time to do hifz, definitely go for it. Now, there's one thing about Shias being weak in hifz, like this is what's mostly known, and our Sunni brothers are stronger in hifz. And what comes out is sometimes in discussions, one of the places where the Shias look weaker is that, you know, the Sunni guy will come up with verses and we'll have to, like, think for 10 minutes and look on in our in our phones to for the verse. And that is seen as a weakness.
Mm.
And again, I want to clarify that that is not a weakness if the person who hasn't memorized it is strong in its meaning. Mm. You can have a person who's memorized it, can quickly throw out verses, but then hasn't understood the depth of it.
Absolutely.
Okay. Compared to someone who might stumble a bit, might recite a verse maybe a little bit wrongly, but has understood what he's actually trying to say.
Through memorizing the Quran, we should not forget the true purpose of associating ourselves with the Holy Book of Allah. It is to understand the core, the depth, the meaning, the teachings, the doctrine, the principles, and the inspirations we can receive from that holy book, and align ourselves, our lives, our personality, our mentality with this luminous scripture. That's all the time we have for today's episode of Youth Station. Until another greeting, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, in weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness.
congratulations to everyone on the 15th of Shaban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly. Nuclear weapons forbidden, increasing uranium enrichment based on countries' needs.
مسئله دوم که بحث سیاسی است که مختصرا عرض می‌کنم مربوط به این مسئله هسته‌ای است.
The second issue, which is a political one and which I will discuss briefly, is about the nuclear issue.
جمهوری اسلامی تا مدت طولانی به همه اون چی که تعهد کرده بود بر اساس تعلیم اسلام که باید به تعهدات عمل کرد.
The Islamic Republic fulfilled all its commitments for a long time based on Islamic teachings. Later on, when it saw that they were acting like that, first the US withdrew from the deal and then others cooperated with it, the Islamic Republic acted on the Holy Quran. If you feared treachery from any group, throw back their covenant to them. So as to be on equal terms. Chapter 8, verse 58. This is a Quranic command. However, our honorable administration did not abandon its commitments, and it only gradually reduced some of the commitments which could be restored to the prior state. If they fulfill their commitments, this reduction of commitments could be restored to the prior state. However, they do not at all mention this. They constantly speak about the issue of Iran and use an arrogant language. It is clear what issues we have with the US. But these three European countries should know that speaking in such an arrogant and conceited manner will seriously incite the hatred of the Iranian nation and the revolution. Such a language will make them more hated than the present time in the eyes of our public opinion.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
بعضی اون دلغک صهیونیست بین‌المللی هم که مرتب حرف میزنه که ما نمیگذاریم شما چه کاره اید که نگذارید
Well, some people, including that international Zionist clown, constantly say that they will not let us build a nuclear weapon. Who are you to prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon? If we decided to build a nuclear weapon, then you and powers greater than you would not be able to stop us. But we decided not to do so because this is our Islamic thinking. Our Islamic thinking says that a weapon which is used for killing civilians, non-military people, and ordinary people is forbidden. It is forbidden, be it nuclear or chemical. Such weapons are forbidden. It is because of the Islamic viewpoint that we do not want to build a nuclear weapon. However, if we wanted to do so, who are you to prevent us? You yourselves do not observe these principles.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
Hours after the Yemeni army launched one of its largest retaliatory attacks on the Saudi-led coalition, thousands of Yemenis took to the streets of Sana'a to mark the National Day of Resilience.
The gathering today is the gathering of those who trust in God. These people have proven that they were able to take advantage of the war to develop their military capabilities. Today, our victory is crowned by our ability to stop Aramco by using our strategic deterrent weapons.
Yemenis say the seventh year of Saudi rule will be different as the Yemeni army is escalating its retaliatory attacks against Saudi facilities, pushing the kingdom to stop its years-long rule and to move toward a political solution to protect its oil giant Aramco from Yemeni attacks.
Yemeni people have withstood the aggression surprisingly. The Saudi enemy declared this criminal war from the White House in Washington to bring the Yemeni people to their knees, but they failed because Yemenis trust in God. 6 years ago, Yemenis woke up to the bombing of Saudi airstrikes and the bloodshed of children and women. And today the Saudis and Emiratis woke up to the burning of their oil companies by our missiles and drones. This proves that Yemeni people are getting stronger year after year.
Earlier, the Yemeni army inaugurated the seventh year with the National Day of Resilience operation against several military and economic targets in Saudi Arabia. The operation is the largest so far and used 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles.
Thousands of Yemenis have gathered to mark the 7th anniversary of Saudi rule and siege of their country. They say their army now is capable of forcing the kingdom to stop its deadly war without conditions. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
In the English town of Batley, a local grammar school has caused major controversy after a teacher showed a blasphemous cartoon of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad to students during a religious studies class. Outraged parents of Muslim students began protesting outside the school gates on Thursday, demanding the school take action against Islamophobia.
The incident from Monday, 22nd of March, must also be investigated from a criminal perspective.
Yes.
Given that it was a clear attempt to stir up religious hatred. We also use this opportunity to call upon the entire British Muslim community to review the materials being taught in their children's schools.
Batley Grammar School reacted quickly, suspending the teacher, launching an investigation, and apologising to parents. However, the British press and politicians have opted to condemn the protesters instead, adding further fuel to the fire.
I was disturbed to see scenes of people protesting outside the school. That is not right. We shouldn't have teachers, members of the staff of schools feeling intimidated.
The creator of the universe, Allah, the most merciful, doesn't need a crowd hanging around outside a school.
Many details about what the protesters have been demanding are not clear. Press TV spoke to locals to find out more.
As far as I know, the parents have been very, very responsible. I mean, many of the protesters are not even parents, and the parents have acted very responsibly, very, very professionally, and they should be commended. You know, they're basically the victims of this situation, but they're also the stars of this situation, that they've basically acted in a calm, collective manner. They've not made any unreasonable demands to the school. They've not asked for anything untoward to happen towards the teacher. They've been very, very responsible, and they should be commended for their stance and for their actions.
The school has acknowledged that the resource used in Monday's lesson was completely inappropriate and had the potential to cause considerable offence within the community. However, many online are now arguing that Muslims need to accept insults on the Holy Prophet as part of freedom of speech, and if they don't like it, they have to essentially lump it. However, with further Muslim action planned elsewhere in the country, and also the media continuing to hype up the story, it's likely that things will continue to escalate going forward. Robert Carter, Batley.
After firing two cruise missiles Sunday, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles early Thursday morning. U.S. President Joe Biden responded.
There will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly. But I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy, but it has to be conditioned upon the end result of denuclearization.
The latest launches are widely considered to be in violation of UN Security Council sanctions against Pyongyang, which are strongly supported by the United States and limit North Korea's ability to develop its economy. North Korea's recent missile tests demonstrate that maintaining the status quo in terms of ongoing United Nations Security Council sanctions is unacceptable to Pyongyang. And experts agree that the timing of the tests was clearly designed to influence the Biden administration's ongoing North Korea policy review. Experts argue that the U.S. needs to live up to the Singapore summit agreement between former U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which was violated with recent joint U.S.-South Korea military drills.
From North Korea's perspective, the South Korea-U.S. military exercises, pressure on human rights, and sanctions are threatening. Pyongyang needs to be guaranteed the right to live. If the U.S. has a sincere attitude before approaching North Korea, they will get a response.
U.S. officials recently toured the region to consult allies. With expectations, the Biden administration's new policy toward North Korea will be announced within weeks. Frank Smith, Seoul.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honor their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy, and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium. This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is